So when we left off a couple weeks ago, we started out the study with kind of a general introduction of 1 Peter. And I asked several questions. We know that 1 Peter was written by Peter because he specifies himself as the author, whereas there are some books that the author isn't necessarily specified. And we read in 1 Peter in 1 Peter 1 and 1 that the letters written to the pilgrims of the dispersion in Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia. And there's been some discussion about whether these were Gentile Jewish Christians. And I think when we read the letter, the emphasis isn't necessarily on whether these are Jewish or Gentile Christians. We see in other letters that there is emphasis placed on whether they are Jewish or Gentiles. In Hebrews, the focus is on Jewish Christians. Romans, I'd argue the focus is somewhat on them being Gentile Christians. 1 and 2 Corinthians, it's obvious that the emphasis is that they are Gentile Christians. Here, 1 Peter, my reading is that the emphasis is placed on these are groups of Christians who are isolated. They're individuals in many different places. And we understand, or we're trying to understand, that 1 Peter is really a letter written for the purpose of encouragement. Encouragement to persecuted Christians. And the fact that it's written to these different groups, to me, emphasizes that encouragement. It says, it is one place where it says, you are not alone. You may be in one of these other places in the region, but be encouraged because there are Christians in other places, such as the ones mentioned in the letter. So, one of the main ideas of 1 Peter is encouragement. So we come to chapter 1, and the first thing I want to point out is something that happens whenever we read the Bible is we take one verse and read it, and we don't necessarily know what's happening in any other verse. So in 1 Peter in chapter 1, one verse that has been cited a number of times that comes up a lot is verse 4. If you just read verse 4 in 1 Peter 1, 4, it says, to an inheritance incorruptible and undefiled and that does not fade away. And when we use this verse to point out that our salvation is in heaven, that our salvation is something that's concrete. You think about things that are on this earth, everything in this earth is going to degrade, decay, pass away. And many preachers and lessons point out to verse 4 as this idea that our salvation is something that can't be degraded. It can't be decayed. It can't be destroyed. It's something that gives us hope. But if you just read that verse, you can use this verse to make that point. But it really isolates it from the rest of the passage. So what I want to emphasize in this class is, what is the rest of the passage? What's the point that the rest of the passage is trying to make? What is the flow of ideas that Peter is trying to communicate? And when you look at the lesson, point number 2, I went through chapter 1 and identified the ideas that are being communicated in chapter 1. And you can look at these are summaries of what, these are my summaries. So you can read chapter 1 and you can kind of come up with a somewhat different idea of exactly what points he's making. But when we read 3 through 5, you know, it says, "Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who according to his abundant mercy has begotten us again to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, to an inheritance incorruptible and undefiled and that does not fade away, reserved in heaven for you, who are kept by the power of God through faith for salvation, ready to be revealed in the last time." And what is the big idea? What's Peter trying to communicate with this passage? So the label that I gave it is that this is a paragraph of praise. It starts out, "Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ." And the purpose of the passage is that we're praising God for giving us hope. Or Peter's praising God for giving us hope. And he identifies what is the reasons for that hope. As I said earlier, that we have an inheritance that's incorruptible. That God has shown us abundant mercy. That he's gotten us to a living hope. All of these different points that support the idea of God is giving us hope. So, to go through kind of the flow of the chapter, we have praise for God for giving us hope. And since God has given us hope, we should rejoice despite trials that we'll face. And that's part of the encouragement. The reason that Peter is encouraging these Christians is that they are facing persecution. It's the answer to the question, if I'm doing everything right, why isn't my life going spectacularly? You know, that's something that's a natural question that we ask when we face difficulties. So Peter tells them to rejoice despite trials. Well, why should we rejoice despite trials? Because of faith. Because of the faith that we have in God. You know, verse 7 says that the genuineness of your faith, being much more precious than gold that perishes, though it is tested by fire, may be found to praise, honor, and glory at the revelation of Jesus Christ. So, we should rejoice despite trials because we have faith. And that faith ends in salvation. There is a point to having faith. Yes.
Another thing would be that it's not our home. Heaven's our home.
Right. That's a big idea that Peter tries to communicate. That heaven's our home instead of this world. So it's kind of logical, you know, since this world's not our home, then we're going to face difficult times in it. So our faith ends in salvation, and it's a salvation that everyone's been expecting before us in the Old Testament. You know, from Adam and Eve, prophecies have been made about the coming of Christ. From Adam and Eve to Moses to all the prophets. And I like to place myself in the shoes of a Jew back then and think about, you know, there's all these prophecies. What do they mean? Who is going to come and how are they going to be fulfilled? And it's an interesting exercise to do because, you know, hindsight's 20/20. We all know that Christ fulfilled all these promises. But when you put yourself in the shoe of a Jew in the old days, in the Old Testament, then what is their conception of who Christ is, of who's going to come and fulfill all these prophecies? So that's just the revelation of Christ as the Messiah, as someone who's fulfilled all these promises and prophecies, is something that is referred to a number of times in the New Testament, including in 1 Peter chapter 1. So we have salvation that has been revealed, and it leads up to a call of action. Peter's not just pointing out all these things for the sake of bragging about God or some, you know, just to say these things. He's saying them for a reason. He's saying them as encouragement, but he's also calling the Christians to continue to be holy. Because that's really the temptation when life doesn't go our way. When things are down, then that is a time of testing. And it's a time when people do lose faith. You hear about when a natural disaster strikes or someone gets sick and they say, well, I've done everything right until now, and now this bad thing's happened to me. Why should I continue having hope? Why should I continue serving a God who's going to let these bad things happen to me? So Peter's encouraging them to continue to be holy despite difficulties in this world. And in some places, it's more common with Paul's writings, but we have these kind of asides. And in chapter 1, the aside here is talking more in depth about redemption in verses 18 through 21. So we'll try and circle back talking about that in a little while. But just following this flow, Peter calls him to be holy. He talks about redemption a little more in depth. And then after the call to be holy, a part of being holy is loving one another. And that's where chapter 1 ends. And we know that the chapters are arbitrary. The chapter divisions aren't inspired by God. Men decided where to place the chapter divisions. But they place those chapter divisions at logical spots. And we see changes or chapter numberings at different breaks where the author goes from one idea to a different idea. So we'll see next week what the idea in chapter 2 is. Well, the idea in chapter 2, Peter goes more into encouragement by group identity. He explains, you know, you are a different kind of people to the world around you. And that's an encouragement. You know, we find encouragement in this group of people. I'm encouraged that all of you guys have come out to listen to whatever comes out of my mouth. You know, we're encouraged because we've all come to the same conclusions about the Bible. We have faith in God. We have faith that He's going to save us. And we've all studied the Word and come to similar conclusions about how to obey Him, that we need to gather together, that we need to partake of the Lord's Supper, that we need to be baptized. And these are beliefs that we get from the Bible that the rest of the world doesn't necessarily hold. So it's encouraging that we all have similar ideas about that. Josh.
And you're talking about their identity. Something Peter's referenced several times already in this letter is the name Jesus Christ. And he specifically points to the resurrection of Jesus Christ, that we've been called to that one hope. You think back in Acts 2, that's another strong point he makes, other apostles make, about the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And that's what we all have faith, and that's what gives us our hope, and that is our identity. Unique from other religions is, and the other religions in their time, and unique from the Jewish religion, is that Jesus Christ is God, saves us by his sacrifice, and that he resurrected the signature stamp of approval, that God confirmed Christ is who he claimed he is Lord, and through him we can save, and that's what we have our faith in. And that's our shared identity and their identity he's referencing regularly already.
Right. The shared identity of believing that Christ was resurrected from the dead. You know, it's something that the world laughs at, scoffs at, but it's something that we understood happened. You know, the body of Christ has never been found. That is one of the most important pieces of evidence that there is a resurrection. Just if you go through the exercise of looking through the Old Testament prophecies and seeing Christ fulfill prophecy after prophecy after prophecy, and then coming to the end where Christ is sacrificed for our redemption, those are powerful ideas that we take and that give us hope. So that's kind of the overview of chapter 1. And I want to try and make you guys talk more than I talk. So let's go to question 1. And in question 1, I asked, what has God given us that should make us happy? Looking at verses 3 and 4 of 1 Peter chapter 1. Or a better way of putting it is, what has God given us that should give us encouragement, according to verse 3 and 4?
A living hope.
That's right. Living hope. 3 and 4. And we have living hope. You know.
Mercy.
Right. Abundant mercy. The resurrection of Jesus. The idea of an inheritance. You know. We, in this life, a lot of people get hung up on inheritances. And as people who have a spiritual inheritance, we understand how much more important that is than just a physical inheritance, or how much more important it should be. So, verses 3 through 5, Peter's saying that God is great for giving us these things. Giving us living hope, giving us resurrection, showing us mercy. And that is an encouragement for us. That we don't have to live life always afraid. We don't have to live life without hope that we have, that something will be there after we die. That's one part of Peter's encouragement.
It would say one thing would be heaven, because that's our hope, is to obtain heaven as our home. That's, you know, we don't get to be able to obtain heaven. He's given us that if we do the first.
Right. And there's a little more emphasis placed on the things that are in heaven and the things that bring us to heaven. When you read verse 4, it says that all of these things, this inheritance is reserved in heaven for you. So it's not always just about heaven, but it's about the things that will bring us there. The mercy. How it was achieved through the death of Christ. So that brings us to question 2. God's given us these things. He's given us mercy, living hope, the resurrection. But what is special about what God's given us? What's
imperishable and undefiled, reserved in heaven?
That's right. It's reserved in heaven. It's imperishable. It's undefiled. You know, no one can go to heaven and remove that inheritance. It's untouchable. And that should be something that encourages us. The inheritance has four characteristics. So I didn't mention a lot, but whenever we read through these letters and we try to understand the flow, one thing that I'd point out about that is when we read, we need to identify kind of the main point and identify the modifiers at that point. If you think about an argument, you make a statement and then you make supporting statements for that argument. And the Bible doesn't necessarily follow that arrangement or flow, but there's a lot of places where Peter's giving us a broad idea and then he's modifying that idea within the text. If you look at the characteristics of the inheritance, you know, we have the incorruptibility of it. And this isn't the first time that is mentioned. If you go back to Matthew chapter 6, verse 19 through 20, in Matthew chapter 6, verse 19 and 20, Jesus says, "Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal. But lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroys, and where thieves do not break in and steal. For your treasure is, there your heart will be also." So, in Matthew chapter 6, verse 19 through 21, the purpose of that passage is that Christ is giving them a call to action, to place their focus in life on heaven, not on building up an earthly kingdom, but on building up a heavenly kingdom. Because all earthly kingdoms will pass away. All the money that we have saved up over years and years will be spent by our kids. You know, we read in Ecclesiastes, that's kind of one of the points made in Ecclesiastes, that no matter what we do, somebody else is going to come in and completely mess it up. But no one can mess up what's in heaven. So that's the same idea. And he's using different words that kind of emphasize different characteristics of the inheritance. You know, incorruptible, undefiled. You think other religions, there's a lot of emphasis on things that are defiled versus things that are undefiled. If someone eats pork, they're undefiled. In the Old Testament, there's a lot of things that can defile a person. But none of those things can reach heaven. If you think of the occult, they have practices or whatever where they put a curse on you, or they put a curse on whatever things are out there. They put a curse on your soul or whatever. But Peter in this is emphasizing that that can't be done. There's nothing in this world. There's no weird voodoo practice or strange ceremony that can touch what's reserved in heaven for us. So that's kind of the facet that's being emphasized with undefiled. He says that it doesn't fade away, which is something that happens in this world. We don't always think about it, but everything is going to fade away, not heaven. And we see that the inheritance is reserved in heaven. So it's not something that can be taken away on this earth. You think about, this is probably not the best example, but, you know, a hotel room. You reserve it. You're expecting it to be there 3 weeks from now when you go on your trip. Or probably a better example would be a plane ticket, right? You reserve a plane ticket, you get there, and they've overbooked a flight, and they've kicked you off onto the next flight, which completely messes up all your connecting flights. Not the case in heaven. That is an inheritance that is reserved. There's nowhere else to be pushed to, but it can be modified. So we find all those things as modifiers of this inheritance and modifiers of just part of the praise that Peter's giving to God. When we go back to chapter 1, the passage really starts out with verse 3 in blessing God. And the reason that he's blessing God is because of this inheritance that is provided to us. And he also assures us that we're kept by the power of God. Verse 5 says that. The inheritance is reserved in heaven for you who are kept by the power of God through faith for salvation, ready to be revealed in the last time. You know, God doesn't just tell us, do this, good luck. He's with us throughout our lives, as Peter is explaining to them. Even though they're scattered to different parts of the world, God can reach them. God is with all of them. And they're kept by his power. So, God is great for giving us hope. If you did all the questions in the previous lesson, I asked for you to write down the subheadings that were in your Bible. And we didn't go through and explain all those, but the subheading for this passage in my Bible is a heavenly inheritance. So you can see that, yes, this passage is partly about heavenly inheritance. But another way you could label that is praise to God for giving us hope. Because the heavenly inheritance is part of that hope, but the other part of that hope is all the actions and all the characteristics of that inheritance. So we go on to verses 6 through 9, and Peter is telling us to, I'll ask question number 3. So Peter just got done pointing out all of these gifts, pointing out all of these characteristics of our inheritance. Why? Why does Peter point out the gifts God's given us, according to verse 6? Right. Peter starts out the book by encouraging them with these positive aspects because they're suffering through these trials. Verse 6 says, "In this you greatly rejoice, though not for a little while, if need be, you have been grieved by various trials." And Peter explains why we're going through these trials. So question 4 I ask, why are we exposed to these trials? According to verse 7.
So that the fruit of your faith may be found to result in praise, glory, and honor of the revelation of Jesus
Christ. Right. There's a couple different reasons that he points out, right? You know, to show the genuineness of your faith. And that is found to praise at the revelation of Jesus Christ. So, Peter is explaining to them that the trials that we go through in life, they're not without a positive purpose. They're not pointless things that just happen to us because of who we are. They serve a purpose. They can show and emphasize the inheritance that we have. They show the faith that we have.
So we should remember Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in there.
Right. You know, and when we go through trials, they're not something that we take joy in at the time. Perhaps we can look back at them and find the silver lining, but they're certainly not something that we take pleasure in going through at any time. So we find the genuineness of our faith, and there's a couple descriptors or modifiers of this faith. So verse 7 points out that one of them is that it's more precious than gold. Verse 7 says that the genuineness of your faith, being much more precious than gold that perishes, though it is tested by fire. And that's the other thing about our faith, that it's tested by fire. And there's other secondary aspects of faith. Question 5, I asked, you know, verse 8 and 9, why are we, what do we find encouraging about Christ? And I know that's kind of a really obvious question. You can make really broad statements about why Christ should encourage us. But Peter chooses to emphasize a couple key things in this letter about what Christ means to us. So according to verse 8 and 9, what are those things?
Salvation of your soul.
Okay. You know, that we're going to receive the end result of our faith. 8 and 9 says that. And another thing that is encouraging is that we haven't seen him, but yet we have faith. You know, at the end of verse 7, we have the revelation of Jesus Christ. And verse 8 says, whom having not seen you love, though now you do not see him, yet believing, you rejoice with joy inexpressible and full of glory, receiving the end of your faith, the salvation of your souls. So we have these secondary descriptions of faith, that we haven't seen them, but we believe. And that is unique, as I was kind of talking about at the beginning of class, that what makes something that makes that faith unique is that people didn't have it before Christ came. They had the promises and the prophecies, but they didn't have the fulfillment of those. And what makes us unique is even though we have the fulfillment of those, we don't have Christ with us physically. We have faith that that's happened in the past, which is unique to it's different from the Old Testament. You know, they didn't see it. We don't see it with our eyes, but we read about it and we believe it because it's been fulfilled. Right.
We still have a hope like they do of the resurrection. We haven't seen that. And we believe that would happen. And that's the very thing that Satan tried to use during their time for the persecution. Some of them would fall away. And they would, because their faith was tested, not, and they were told by some people the resurrection's already come.
Right.
Or they would be worried about people in the past that have died. But they didn't be able to enjoy this lesson. So, amidst these tribulations,
right. The resurrection is definitely a source of encouragement, but it's also something that if we don't hold on to tightly, it can be used to discourage Christians.
That's how that would work. You'd say, y'all haven't, you know, maybe there's someone else saying, how do you even know Christ resurrected? You've never seen him. You didn't see him walking around. Same thing with us today. You know, Christ even acknowledged with Thomas, blessed are those who did not see but believe. So our faith that Christ resurrected is founded on plenty of objective evidence, but we didn't see it firsthand. And we're given credit for living a life in our living hope that Christ did resurrect, and that's waiting for us. And that faith we have to have, that we're given protection by having that faith to go through the world, through the trials, that's how we'll receive that inheritance.
Yeah, I like how you put that. You know, that's part of what Peter's saying, is that those who haven't seen deserve credit for having that faith. You know, as people who are go through trials and persecutions, it's to your credit that you hold on to your faith through those experiences.
Yep. I was going to say, talking about inheritances, you know, how many times have we heard the story where someone's waiting on Aunt Millie to pass away so they can get all of her money, and lo and behold, she gives it to her pet cat, and, you know, they're left with nothing.
Uh-huh.
And so he's saying, you can count on this, you can trust this, and you can commit your life to this. You are going to give this.
Yeah. And how many times have, you know, you heard stories about people who were expecting a big inheritance, and the person dies and the bill comes due, you know, for all the debts that they ran up before they died. So those are definitely things that, when it comes to Christ, are not factors. And what's the... So this inheritance has been... This salvation has been sought for in the past. In verses 10 through 12, that's kind of what he talks about. That the people in the Old Testament looked for this coming event. And that makes it all the more special that we live in a time when that event has come, and those promises and prophecies have been fulfilled. One of the things that God shows in the Old Testament is that He fulfills His promises. He told Abraham, I'll give you a nation, I'll give you land, and I'll give you the blessing to all nations. And He fulfilled those promises. And I think that's something that is emphasized in a lot in the Old Testament. Because as Christians in the New Testament, we have promises that have been made to us. That heaven is there for us, even though we may have to go through these trials. And how much more special is it for us that we are at the point where we've seen these prophecies come true? And that's kind of what verse 10 through 12 is talking about. So he says all these things for a reason. So I skipped question 6, but I will go to question 7. You know, whenever... This is something I'm going to say a lot, but whenever you see therefore, the question I want you to ask yourself is, what is therefore linking together? And that's what I asked in question 7. What two ideas are linked by therefore in verse 13? So we read in when we go back and we look at the previous passage and look at verse 10 through 12, he starts out with the salvation. You know, this is what the salvation is. This is the salvation the prophets have inquired and searched carefully. And you go through the rest of those verses, it's all talking about the salvation. It's the salvation that has been searched for, but it's also the salvation that's been revealed. You know, verse 12 says, to them it was revealed that, not to themselves, but to us, they were ministering the things which now have been reported to you, though those you have preached the gospel to you by the Holy Spirit sent from heaven, things which angels desire to look into. So when you see therefore, you may not necessarily be able to go to the previous verse to see it, what the idea is linked. You may have to go a couple verses up. But therefore is linking salvation with the next call to action, which is setting our hope on grace, which is verse 13. Rest your hope, therefore gird up your loins of your mind, be sober. Rest your hope fully upon the grace that is to be brought to you at the revelation of Jesus Christ. And we're going to have to end there. So thanks for your attention.